Well, this is your host, Todd Lewis, the Praiseify Podcast. I'm again joined by Keith Preston and Derek Jensen to discuss how the left lost its mind. Now, we've all been sort of talking about the periphery of this question over the last couple of years on various streams and podcasts we've done. And one thing that I'll say is when we look at the modern left and how it's gone crazy, it's the question is in the way it's gone crazy. So the very same people that would have opposed genital mutilation in, say, Islamic countries, the liberal types, are now in favor of something that is an even worse form of genital mutilation, and they don't seem to lose any sleep about it at all. They don't even seem to see the contradiction. And the question is, like, what happened? How did we go from Bernie Sanders saying that open borders is a Koch brothers conspiracy to let's have open borders, which is against, you know, the classic left doctrine since forever, because they know that immigration dilutes the labor supply. When did the left literally start taking the opposite position on everything that it used to stand for? Now we see prominent leftists bemoaning the fact that we're leaving Afghanistan because we're leaving, you know, minority groups to the Taliban. I thought the whole point of the left was to get the Americans out of Afghanistan. And there's a whole lot of particular examples we could point to. But I think if we look at how this happened, there's the means by which this happened is we're not allowed culturally to call things what they are. So in earlier iterations of the culture war, the discussion about abortion, the discussion about sodomy, we all know what those things are. We just aren't allowed to say it. We all know what transgender operational surgery is. We're just not allowed to say it. And so we've been conditioned for decade after decade after decade to talk about these hot button issues without actually talking about them. Because if we actually talk about them, we might bring up uncomfortable things about them that we're not allowed to do. And so there's this overall conditioning where people are at the point of self-censorship where they don't want to talk about them in these ways. Now, if we look at sort of the guiding intellectual streams and trends that are behind this, we can talk about, from the point of view of ontology, we can start with nominalism, the idea that there are no forms or substances. All we have are these convenient labels that are expressions of mental categories. They're not necessarily embodied in anything real. The concomitant ontology is muriological nihilism, which says that one way it's been described is there's no such thing as chairs, just atoms shaped chairwise. It's just atoms shaped in any configuration you want. So if you can just shape material reality to any configuration you want, and there's no essential thing there, then we can begin to see where a lot of these radical ideas are coming from. And the epistemology that I believe is driving this is post-structuralism. So with Foucault, power is discourse. Power is words. And so we have this sort of deconstructionist attitude that hegemonic discourses or hegemonic paradigms have to be deconstructed because they represent power. Not so much necessarily the state, not so much necessarily guns, though they may be a part of it. It's discourse. But what ends up happening is in the same way that Alan Bloom describes in The Closing of the American Mind, when Marxist deconstructionism was applied to Marx in the 80s, it led to a decline in, like, you know, red, you know, card-carrying Marxists because the whole facade crumbled. We're beginning to see that this unchecked use of discourse as power has begun to deconstruct the left itself. It was initially used against the right capitalists or the leftovers of conservative institutions in Europe and the United States. But in part, I think because of lack of targets, but also because of the natural process of epistemological critique, it's turned in on itself. And so the modern left is going through a phase similar to what Marxism went through in the 80s when its own methodology is turned upon itself. Now, there's a lot of ways we could go at this question from there, but I'd like to offer it to you, Derek, and see which way you want to go with this.
Well, I want to thank you for mentioning nominalism, because when you were starting by saying, when you asked the question, when did the left go wrong? I believe you said that somewhere in there. I was going to pipe up, it went wrong 2,500 years ago with Antisthenes. And, for Antisthenes was an opponent of Plato. I think Plato's kind of crazy too, but Antisthenes' big deal was that his ideas were called nominalism. And it's that he's famous for saying, horseness I cannot see. So his big deal was that there was no such thing as a horse. There is no category of a horse. There are merely all these individuals who happen to have four legs. And I mean, there's three perspectives on this, two of which I think are insane. One is that there are horses, and then there's a universal essence of horseness that even exists without horses. I think that's kind of nuts. And then Antisthenes' idea was that there is, the middle idea, which I think makes sense, which is horses all have something in common, and there is this thing we call a horse. And Antisthenes was, no, there is no such thing as a horse. There are only individuals. And that's fine, Derek, but who cares what happened 2,500 years ago? Part of the problem is that this has come to today in things like queer theory, where queer theorists will argue, I'm not making this up, this is queer theorists, will argue that there is no such thing as the child, and that the pedophile is a phantom. And what there are all these children who are all very different, and you can't make any category at all. And instead, you just have some children, they say, are kinky. Some children want to have sex with adults. And what would be wrong with an adult who wants to allow the child to explore their sexuality? Their perspective, not mine. And my point is that a lot of this stuff comes from nominalism. And one more thing I want to mention about this is that this is part of, and I know we're jumping way ahead, and I'm sorry for that, but this is part of the problem with Antifa or the Black Bloc right now, is that this is one of their arguments they use to avoid responsibility. There is no such thing as Antifa. There's no such thing at all. All there is a whole bunch of individuals all wearing the same uniform and all acting in the same ways, following the same philosophy. And of course, you could say the same thing about a football team. You know, it's like, this is just, so this is a long way of saying that I think that, and it doesn't answer our question, when did the left go crazy or how did the left go crazy? But one of the problems is this nominalism that has taken over academia, taken over queer theory. This makes me really angry. They're trying to queer is about two things. One is about violating boundaries, which we can talk about later. The other thing about the queer is, and they say this, it's about destroying all categories. So they say there is no category man, no category woman, which is just nonsense. There is no category male, no category female. They try to queer nature, that there are no distinctions between species. It goes on and on. It is a form of madness, and we can explore it more or not as you wish. But anyway, I think I'm so glad you said the word nominalism is part of the problem.
All right, Keith.
I tend to be interested in the, not only the ideas that feed into some of the phenomena we're talking about now, but also the more material conditions and technological conditions, as well as the social and cultural circumstances in which some of these things come about. One of the things about the cultural revolution that came out of the 1960s that I think is often overlooked is that I tend to think that that was made possible largely by the existence of a post-scarcity society. If you go back and you look at what the left was about for most of its history, for the most part, it was about, well, I guess if you trace it back far enough, you could say it was about the bourgeoisie versus the historic Ancien regime. It was against the aristocracy and the monarchy and all that. But for most of its history, the left was identified with socialism or with the labor movement more broadly. And it was mostly about improving the material conditions of the working class. Now, you also had sectors of the left that were interested in feminism and women's rights, that overlapped also with abolition. And there were, you know, there was an element of the left that was into temperance, and some were even into eugenics and stuff like that. But for the most part, the central thrust of the left for most of its history, for at least a century or so, was the improving the material conditions of the working class. But then in the post-war period, post-World War II period, we got to the point where in the most developed countries, which meant the United States and Western Europe and maybe Australia and a few other places, we have really for the first time in history achieved a post-scarcity society where most people really weren't that worried about where they were going to get food and shelter and things like that. That's not to say people didn't have to work. That's not to say people never struggled. But, you know, in the, you know, Derek and I are roughly the same age, and in the United States that we grew up in, we had a middle class. We had what was really a working class that lived like an upper middle class by world standards and by historical standards. I mean, for the first time in history, working class people could get credit cards and have two vehicles and live in suburban neighborhoods and have, electronic, dishwashers and stereos and televisions and central heating and air conditioning, things that would have been inconceivable to even rich people a century earlier. So I think in that kind of social circumstance where most people's material needs are met on not only on a basic level, but for a whole lot of people on a much more than basic level, then you start having the opportunity to think about other things in society that you prefer to change. And I think that's why you see a shift in the left away from material, emphasis on material needs to more social factors. And at least early on, some of that may have been serious. They may have been serious about the oppression of blacks in the South or women's rights or other issues. But I think over time, like anything, once something becomes a dominant paradigm and becomes institutionalized, then it often tends to go off the rails. For some people, it just becomes a means of opportunism. For some people, it becomes a business. For other people, it just becomes a type of intellectual masturbation. And I think with the left and the West today, we see all of those things converging. We see a lot of people who are so-called leftists, quote-unquote, for whom whatever they're doing, it really is just a business. It's careerism or something like that. You know, a classic example is this person, Robin DiAngelo. This is a white woman who, an older white woman who goes around and lectures, in corporate seminars for something like $15,000 a shot about how, you know, white people need to be less racist. And, you know, and basically what she really does is just talk about her own racism, about how racist her family was and her own prejudicial feelings about black people and things like that. You see that kind of stuff. You see people in the academic world who try to promote their own careers by just coming up with the most bizarre theories they can think of. Well, okay, this person published this, advocating this point of view. I'm going to top that. I'm going to go further and further and further. And this has long been an issue. Like I know Noam Chomsky once said that he thought Lacan was basically just a conscious charlatan. He was just trying to push the French intellectual culture as far as it could go and just be as far out as possible and say, well, you thought that was crazy. How about this? And see what would stick. So I think that that's really a kind of problem that the left has today. If we're talking about where the left went off the rails, I think that's largely rooted in the fact that this is a post-scarcity left. You know, it's not about, you know, it's not starving peasants or exploited workers resisting bosses and feudal lords or anything like that. It's largely a middle class circle jerk for middle class intellectuals.
I think one thing that is a good way to pursue this craziness of the left is, I know certainly you, Derek, are very involved in the debate between the third wave feminists, derisively called TERFs, and transgender community. Yeah. Go ahead.
Actually, it's second wave feminists.
Second wave. Okay. And, and so, There's a couple ways I think we could look at the rise of the transgender movement. The first is sort of experiential. So the idea that there is, in the same way that someone like Marilyn Manson, his sort of whole persona and shtick was the result of childhood trauma. He was a latchkey kid, and his grandfather sexually abused him growing up. And so that sort of led him down this certain path. There's this dislocation that comes with the rapid modernity over the last 60 years that leads to people experiencing trauma either at the workplace or because, you know, they are abused by, because of this highly individual, autonomous, anonymous society, abused by other people, and they don't speak out. A lot of these kids, when they're abused as kids, they're kids. They don't even know how to process what's happened to them, but it sets them on a course where they end up in a certain kind of ideology, a certain kind of way of thinking. And so that's sort of like an existential explanation for what's going on. But I think with the transgender movement, what we see is a certain line of thinking that has turned in on itself. So what we see with second wave feminism, but really more broadly the left in general, is in more traditional societies, perceived biological realities determined gender norms and gender. And the left was saying, no, we don't want to do that anymore. We're not going to let perceived biological realities determine gender norms and gender. But they didn't necessarily deny those realities. They said that they didn't want those to determine gender and gender norms. But then the next stage then is, then what determines the essence of these things, whether it's, you know, men and women or adults and children or what have you. And so then the next thing is, I'll give you a good example. So there was this new atheist type guy who was interviewed on the Joe Rogan show recently. And he said that, you know, when this transgender movement stuff started coming out, he was like, well, look, you know, we can separate gender and sex. And as long as they don't come over into the two biological sex category, I'm okay with that. But then he said, you know, as he was working in whatever biological profession he was working, it eventually said that the 11, whatever, 12 genders now had 11 and 12 sexes to go with it. And it crossed that barrier back into biology. So once you've argued that these roles are social constructs, then it becomes very easy to argue that the biological realities that underpin them are social constructs. And so from that inference, you can then go back and say, well, we're just going to tinker with the biological realities and say that they're social constructs too, or at least representative of social constructs. And so then you get the trans woman saying to the second wave feminist the same thing that the second wave feminist was saying to the traditionalist, but it's like a 30-year lag. So, Derek.
Yeah, I don't really agree that. I agree that that is how the social process has worked, but it has involved a huge logical flaw that is core to postmodernism. And in fact, it ends up, you know, honestly, this issue and many of these issues and postmodernism, post-structuralism, all, and I'm not kidding, they make me wonder whether humans are sentient. Because postmodernism and queer theory too, postmodernism asked a really, really smart question, which is, how is it that some narratives get valorized, to use their word, and some narratives get suppressed? And I think that's a really important, really good question. How is it that that we always hear that Columbus is a hero, and we don't hear quite so often that, you know, he participated in genocide and he was a slaver and he was not nice to his crew, you know, and whatever other things. And so I think the question of how do the story, and this is true in an individual relationship too. So, you know, let's say that Keith and I are in a relationship, and let's say that, I cook dinner and Keith shows up late, and then he shows up 20 minutes late, and I'm mad at Keith because you always show up late, and he's mad at me because you always complain at everything I do. We have two different narratives happening in this relationship, and this happens all the time. And so the postmodernists and post-structuralists were asking this, and you both know this stuff, that they were asking this on a large scale, and they came up with the stupidest possible answer, which is that instead of recognizing that yes, our perceptions are filtered through these various narratives, they came up with the idea that there is no reality to that underpins these narratives. And that's just stupid. And queer theory did the same thing. Queer theory asked a really important question, which is, how is it that some sexual acts are considered acceptable and some sexual acts are considered unacceptable? That is a great question. And they came up with the stupidest possible answer, which is that all sexual acts must be acceptable. Right? That's just immature black and white thinking. That's the sort of black and white thinking that we get when we're four or something. And it's the same with the trans issue, that the notion that if a little girl wants to work on cars, she should be allowed to work on cars, that makes perfect sense to me. The notion that only boys can work on cars, or only boys will be interested in working on cars, I can see how it's for the most part true that generally boys want to work on cars more than girls do. How much of that is social, how much is physical, I don't know. I don't particularly care. I just think when I was 22, I went to buy a truck, and the mechanic I happened to know, who was the best mechanic around, who was a friend of mine, was a woman in a lesbian relationship. She was 22-year-old, card-carrying. I know these are cliches, but it's just true. She wore coveralls all the time, and she was, you know, what would within that context be called, I guess, a bull dyke, a butch. I mean, she's a big woman who, and I took her with me to buy the car because she knew cars better than anybody else I knew. That's cool. And, you know, it's this line from the 70s, free to be me or you. And then there's this jump that therefore somehow, but sex is real. It's not a social construct. That's the thing, is we have this profound confusion over narrative and reality, such that we can believe. See, I don't think it's a slippery slope. I'm not sure you were saying that, but I think it's a completely different category between a social category and a physical category. I can pretend all I want I'm a dog, but a dog is not a human. And that's not to say that dogs aren't wonderful, and maybe they're as smart as humans. Maybe they're smarter than humans. Postmodernism makes me think so. But that doesn't mean that the category dog is a social construct. And just because there are this happens in nature too, that I've seen people argue, postmodernists and people trying to queer nature and anti-environmentalists will argue that because barred owls and spotted owls can interbreed, therefore there is actually no species distinction, which means there's no reason to protect spotted owls. Same with red wolves and coyotes. So red wolves and coyotes can interbreed, therefore there is no species designation. And just because there's some squishiness at the edges doesn't mean there's not these real categories. And that's what you always need to remember, is it doesn't matter whether we're talking about being a Major League Baseball player or being a plumber. I mean, anybody can do plumbing, but that doesn't alter the fact that there are certified plumbers. And that's a thing. Anyway, so that's my ramble on that. The problem, taking this back to what's gone wrong with the left, is, and how the left has gone crazy, is that the left has become disconnected from, as Keith said, material reality, which includes class reality, and it also includes the physical reality of sex, of species, for God's sake. Anyway, yeah.
I just want to make a point of clarification real quick to help you out, Derek. The point that I was making was that by arguing that biological realities don't inform what we would call social constructs, social realities, and any appeal to that was then labeled as bigoted, racist, sexist, whatever you want to call that, it then opened the door for a further critique of biological realities, such that biological realities themselves don't exist. And that then culminates in mere logical nihilism, where everything is just atoms shaped whichever way you want.
I don't disagree with that. I would say that if I were to make that critique, I would say that biological reality doesn't, I would not agree that biological reality doesn't inform social reality. I would say it doesn't completely determine. That's where I would draw what I would perceive as a sane line in that sand. So it doesn't inform it, but it doesn't absolutely determine it, but it does certainly inform it.
All right, Keith, sorry about that.
Well, I think another issue here, going back to the question of material reality, is the influence of actual capitalism and related developments like technology on what the left is today. There was a very interesting study that was published by Thomas Piketty, the French economist, a few months ago. And Piketty is most well known for being a critic of globalization and things like that. But what he did in this study was more or less confirm what I'd already thought for years. And he examined the electoral systems and the political parties of 21 Western democracies. And what he found in virtually all of these was that the, if you broke it down to say the dominant conservative or right party versus the dominant left party, what you see is that a profound shift had taken place since the post-war period. Like in the post-war period, it was the case that the left party was the working class party, you know, the poor and working class party. The right party was the wealthy and affluent people's party. You know, there may be some gray area in that, but that was the general breakdown. But what he found is that over time, and certainly today, the two parties largely became rival factions of the elite. In the sense, and the analogy that he made is to the caste system in India. He said, imagine if you had a party in India where the right party is the party of, say, the merchant class and the military class, and the left party is the party of the Brahmin class, you know, the scholars and priests and, you know, whatever the Brahmins are. And that is considered the basis of your political orientation. Well, where does that leave the workers? Where does that leave poor people? You know, where does that leave everybody else, really? And I think that's really the essence of what left-right politics is in the entire Western world. In fact, it was confirmed by this study. You know, in most of the Western world today, the left-right politics is really the different sections of the left being the, George Packer, the writer for The Atlantic, he said, well, essentially it amounts to the left is the smart people's party, meaning academics and journalists and professional people, what some people call the professional managerial class. And then the right is more the business people's party. The traditional corporations, the chamber of commerce types, as well as the military industrial complex and all that. One thing that I've also noticed is that this is particularly true in the United States, but I think it's true in other parts of the developed world. And I think American political culture influences other parts of the world in this direction. And that is, the more polarized the society has become over all kinds of things, and there are a lot of reasons for that as well, but the more the political parties and political leaders and opinion makers and all of that have had to reach out to the far fringes of culture in order to create a base for themselves or to create constituents for themselves. And that's why I think that you see so many people, one reason why you see so many people on the left reaching out to the far, far furthest cultural fringes you can find in order to bring those into the pantheon of the oppressed or whatever. You see same things that are comparable on the right. You see these groups like QAnon and that kind of stuff on the right. But I've noticed that it seems like a lot of people on the left, particularly the cultural left, they keep trying to reach out further and further and further to the margins and find points of view that were, you know, that are increasingly crazy. Some of the things Derek was talking about. And you see that with all the issues. You see, for example, the left was always the party of civil rights for ethnic minorities. Well, okay, fine, good. All right. But then it goes further and further and further to you have people that say, well, there's really no such thing as ethnic groups. They're just interchangeable with each other. You know, similar to the, the idea that there's no such thing as gender or whatever. And then it goes even further, where now you have people who think of themselves as transracial, where you can actually become another race or something like that if you want. You have this Rachel Dolezal woman who was trying to promote this idea and saying this is a legitimate identity. And over time, I see more and more of that kind of stuff appearing from the left. You have this other Ken movement that they say, well, if you're a human, well, you don't have to be human. You can be a dog if you want. You can be a vampire. You can be an extraterrestrial. You know, be a witch or something. The problem that I see with that is that, you know, whatever the motivations of the people who buy into this way of thinking, it seems like there are other forces that are facilitating this and trying to legitimize this and indulge this. And I think there are motives for that. I think it's about trying to build constituents for different kinds of political parties and movements. I also think in the economic realm, you know, we've experienced in recent decades the digital capitalist revolution, where like digital capitalism, thanks to the microchip, is superseding industrial capitalism. And we've also had parallel to that economic globalization. Well, globalization, you know, is not something that's about cultural particularities. Like one thing that the left still constantly claims is that, you know, well, capitalism is about racism and sexism and homophobia, and, you know, and to which I would say, yeah, maybe it was at one point, but also capitalism is dynamic in the sense that capitalists want to constantly expand into new markets, find new constituents. They also need to develop new technologies. They need skilled workers and all of these kinds of things. So that tends to have the effect of breaking down barriers between traditional cultures and nationalities and social distinctions and things like that. And I think that feeds into some of this kind of thing as well.
Yeah, one thing. Go ahead, Derek. Go ahead.
Two things, Keith. One is that you said some of that the last time we talked, and I don't know if I told you directly, but I thought it was one of the most brilliant things I've ever heard. This whole sort of Brahmin class versus business class, that has been so helpful to me in understanding the way the modern left and right works. There's two classes of the elite. So thank you for that analysis. And then another thing that I've wanted to mention, you mentioned technology a couple of times, and I think part of one of my things is that I think that when you left or right or anywhere else, when you become unhinged from reality, it is going to, by definition, make your movement more insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. And part of the technological problem, I think, has been the explosion of the image culture for the last 70 years, that I think we did not evolve to see things on, to see stories played out for us as though they're real, without getting a little bit confused as to whether they're real. And I know that if we all watch Lord of the Rings, we all know that orcs don't exist in the real life, or at least everybody but Utterkin knows that orcs don't exist in real life. But it does affect us on a really profound level. And a great example of this was when I was a kid, I jumped off the roof, because in movies I saw people jump off the roofs, land, roll, and everything's fine. I had no idea that they jumped, and then there was a pad down here, and then they showed somebody falling like 3 feet. And fortunately, it was not a very tall roof, and I merely landed hard. I did not, like, break anything. But it was an important lesson to me at 5 years old or 6 years old in the difference between reality and screen reality. And I think that being a culture of the image has confused us on a profound existential level as to what's real. And I saw you, nodding early on. So if you want to take over and make some sense of my rambling, that would be great.
Well, there's a lot to work with here, but I think the first thing that I'd like to do is sort of contextualize your earlier discussion on philosophy. So there's what's called realism, which what Plato held, the idea that these things, these abstract forms exist necessarily somewhere in the unity of the forms or the mind of God or in some noumenal realm. Then there's Aristotle, who had moderate realism, which said that these things did exist, but only insofar as they had physical existence. And I think that's the position you're advocating.
Yes, that would definitely, I would be thumbs up for Mr. A.
And then nominalism is Antisthenes. Now,
what comes down there?
Yeah. Now, what I'm saying then is, if we look at
Plato, I'm sort of mixed on. Anyway, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Now, again, this is a bit of a bolder claim, and we can maybe get into this a little bit later. I think the project of the left, since its beginning as a ideological and political force, has essentially been that of Antisthenes, whether they knew it or not, based on the set of assumptions that they chose to start with. That's a little bit too broad, but that's sort of where I'm coming from. So when I see the left, I see all of this as a continuation of the same nihilistic deconstructionism. Now, that's not to say that everybody who's a leftist believes that, but the ideas that are sort of governing the historical evolution of this movement, I think, are and can be traced back to that.
So can you give us a couple examples from classical leftism where you would think they were falling into the Antisthenes trap?
Well, yeah. So the example that I would use is when we look at the biological realities that differentiate between men and women, when we can talk about how those biological realities affect social norms. Now, yes, if we look at, say, a classically traditional Muslim, Catholic, Hellenic, pagan, Protestant, we all know they're basically traditional and women basically have the same place in society. But the way that's manifested is different. There is some variation within that broad, more conservative take. But what I would argue is that what the left is doing in the 19th and 20th centuries, when it's expanding that, there's a difference between a degree in kind and a degree, or distinctions of degree between a kind and essentially. So, you know, a degree in degree is just distinction in degree is just a little bit more. It's a little bit hotter, a little bit colder. A distinction in kind is it's totally different, a horse and a dog. And what I'm arguing is that the left has created this rupture between biological realities when they're pushing for a set of social norms that could only make sense. It's no longer a distinction of degree as, say, you know, a Muslim society versus a Hellenic pagan society. Rather, it's a degree in kind. And that degree in kind, whether consciously or not, was a assumption of an implicit denial of biological realities because it was walking away from being informed by them.
So, sorry to personalize this, but where does my auto mechanic female friend from 1982 fit into this?
Well, the way it fits in is because technology is the method by which this new paradigm was established. So there's all sorts of technologies that, I mean, if we really want to get into, we could, but I think that'd be a little sensitive because some of the technologies that allow this to be possible are rather sensitive, allow this to happen.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is was the fact that she, and maybe I'm misunderstanding you completely, was the fact that she was a good mechanic, was that, what's the relationship, A, what's the relationship between biology and that, and B, what is that a difference in degree or kind?
Right. Well, okay, so we're talking about social
roles. I'm trying to understand your perspective.
Sure. So like social roles, right? So the differences in social roles. In a traditional society, the predominant social role for women was childbearing. And that was justified based on biology. Whereas the left has taken a different tack, saying that we're going to define women's social roles in spite of that, or a contradistinction to that. And what I'm arguing is that right there is in at least one of many cases where a fundamental breach was made, which creates the entry point for a fundamental denial of biology.
Okay, I will, I'm going to, tentatively agree with you, and I'm going to agree with you specifically with the word entry point, because I'm thinking about something Joseph Campbell said, that he said that for those in whom a social order works, he said it much better, for those in whom a social order works, for those in whom a mythology works, there exists a sense of connection with the universe and of meaning. So if Catholicism really works for you, you have a couple thousand year path that is open to you, and you can walk on that path, and it will provide meaning for your life. It will provide a sense of accord with the universe. But if it doesn't work for you, then you have to go on what he called the hero journey, which is a very dangerous journey. It's, you have to find meaning for yourself in the universe, and you have to find your own, sorry for the cliches, but you have to find your own path. And that was, he said, the essence of the mythological hero journey. And so the thing I find really interesting is that, and the place where we might come together on this is that if that traditional, if those traditional ideas work for you, that's great. If the traditional ideas don't work for you, you've got to find them on your own. And the good news is they can be found on your own and they can make sense. The bad news is you can also go down some really ridiculous paths and end up with post-structuralism and queer theory and trans ideology and what we see in the mind, critical race theory, and a bunch of things that don't make any sense. So the point is, what I'm trying to get at is a conservative culture would make sense for some things. And if it doesn't make sense, you might make new sense or you might make nonsense. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I think so. But I want to give this to Keith first before we go further. Go ahead, Keith.
Well, if we want to go back and talk about examples of how the left may have gotten off the rails within the context of a discussion of, you know, philosophies become problematic to the degree that they are separated from actual reality. There's a really interesting work on this that influenced my own thinking quite a bit, and that's a book by Thomas Sowell that was published back in the 1980s called A Conflict of Visions. And what Sowell was arguing for was the idea that he was talking about the differences between the left and the right in modern times. And there's always this big question among political scientists and political theorists about what is the left and what is the right. I'm somebody personally that doesn't entirely identify with either one. But in a conventional sense, you can define left and right in a lot of different ways. Some people will say, well, the right is about conserving what is, whereas the left is about change. Or some people will say the right is about hierarchy and authority and inequality, and the left is about universal human equality. Or some people will say the right is about tradition, and the other people on the left will say, well, no, tradition oppresses us and tradition is outdated. We need to move forward and change things for the better. And I think all of those are legitimate definitions of left and right in terms of how people perceive them or use them. But Sowell's approach was interesting. He was saying that you have a difference between a constrained and unconstrained vision. And he traced this model of thinking all the way back to the ancient Greeks that we're discussing now. And he was saying that people on the left implicitly tend to identify with what is more of an unconstrained vision. And that's the idea that, for example, utopia is possible. Or he discussed quite a bit the idea of human perfectibility that came out of the Enlightenment. Well, you know, with humans can, you know, through education and correct social institutions and evolution and all that, human beings can become perfectible. Whereas the people who are on the right tend to have more of what Sowell called a constrained vision, and that is human possibilities are limited. You know, there's only so many things we can do. He calls it the tragic vision, the idea that well, there are just certain realities that human beings have to face because that's what it is. And if you deny that, you're going to have problems. For example, to use a somewhat extravagant example, there's the idea of, well, wouldn't it be nice if it was springtime year round? You know, a lot of people would love that, you know, perfect, but that's not the reality that we live in. And if you try to live life like it's going to be springtime year round, where you're going to be awfully cold in the winter when you go outside without winter clothes, because you're just assuming it's going to be spring. And I think that a lot of folks, on the left tend to increasingly over time develop this idea that, you know, of an unconstrained vision, that, you know, that tangible or observable realities don't really matter. We can overcome those. Now, you find that in a lot of historic radical thinking too. If you go back and read some of the utopian writers from, say, the 19th century, well, some of that stuff got pretty far out as well. Like Charles Fourier would write about intentional communities where you had rivers of lemonade and things like that, which maybe today you would have the technology, you could actually make that happen. I mean, that might be possible today. But I do think that that's an issue where I come across that quite a bit when I have debated left-wingers and right-wingers. Like, you know, on social media and all that, I'll debate both sets of ideas, you know, left-winger and right-wingers and things that are kind of in between or neither fish nor fowl. And what I will typically find is that people who come from a more left slant, I think, tend to have a somewhat more utopian view of things, in the sense that they deny certain fundamental elements of the human condition. A good example is what we saw recently with the Afghanistan withdrawal. You know, you see a lot of people on the left lamenting, well, you know, the Taliban are going to take over, they're going to oppress women, and yeah, all that's probably going to happen. But yeah, and it's an eighth century society, and that's what happens in those kinds of societies, and you can't just go in and tamper with it and think you're going to get something different.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess to make my point to you, Derek, a little more clear, is that when we look at modern left thinking and its sort of denial of essentialism, that there are essential essences in things, for lack of a better word, karmic relationships between cause and effect of actions, the left over the last 100 years at least seems to me to be clearly trying to escape the consequences of human actions. The entire industry of contraception and abortion is an attempt to escape consequences. A lot of antibiotics is a used to escape consequences. Welfare and various social and governmental structures are set in place to avoid consequences. And if you create but it's all done using technology. They're not avoiding consequences by doing something magic, unless you want to call technology magic. And I know Arthur C. Clarke thinks of the same thing, but that's neither here nor there. But again, not to get into too long a spiel, the idea is that the way I view the left is a political expression of nominalism, where it just seeks to dissolve things to its constituent parts. Especially looking at leftist revolutions throughout history, they don't have an idea of how to rebuild the Commonwealth. In France and Russia and Latin America, they just burn it down, and then there's a power vacuum and a military dictator takes over. And so again, there's a lot there. I'm not saying that's necessarily, I can get into all that now, but that's just where I'm coming from in this broader perspective. Back to you, Derek.
So one of the things that I'm taking from this that I agree with is there is a profound contradiction in the left, in that it does claim to be about class analysis and has in some ways been about class analysis, but at the same time, class analysis and nominalism can't go together, because nominalism is antithetical to class analysis. I mean, if there's no such thing, I mean, if there's not even a category horse, how can there be a category worker? How can there be a category owning class? And so that's one thing. And there's something that is sort of jumping topics, but it's something that has been burning a hole inside of me for years. Two things whenever I think on this topic, and I would like to hear both of your responses to this. One of them is, I understood early in my political awakening that the right lies, and I gained that understanding from Ronald Reagan, because I voted for him in 1980. And the reason I did is because he said he was going to balance the budget, and then he didn't balance the budget, and there was not much press accountability. Like, nobody ever mentioned it again. And I was like, well, he just lied. And I know, like, you know, I was 19, but 19 is still late to the party to understand that politicians lie. And then something that one of the ways that I go against the tenets of the left, and I want to come back to the tenets of the left in a second, is that I have my whole life believed that there are things that people can do that can cause them to forfeit the right to live. So I don't have a theoretical problem with the death penalty. And I have no problem with Ted Bundy getting executed. You know, we can list any number. And being aware of that, that was one of the first places where I noticed how often the left lies. And it has to do with anti-death penalty rhetoric, that so often, like, there's a billboard up in Ohio right now that says, for every 5 people executed in Ohio, 1 was found innocent. And nerd that I am, I went through and looked at all the people executed in Ohio, and there were some cases I couldn't find anything about, but of all the cases I found, only 2 of them claimed innocence. And one of them, not even his attorneys believed him because his defense was schizophrenia. And 2 was a guy who claimed innocence but couldn't explain how he got the dead person's credit cards or their blood on his clothes. But they just brazenly make this claim. And you see these claims everywhere. And then it's just that level of lying opens some stuff for me in terms of what else is the left lying about. Okay, so that's one thing. And then the other thing is that, you know, I'm agreeing with everything. I mean, both of you are saying so many great things. You talked about, Keith, you talked about the left being against hierarchy on some level, and I'm not quibbling with that, but what I'm going to say is my own experience of, you know, I associated with anarchists for a while, and one of the things I discovered about anarchism is that, and I was raised a fundamentalist Christian, a Seventh-day Adventist, and you know, anarchists talk about no gods, no masters, but anarchism is more fundamentalist than this Christian sect I was in as a kid. That when I've deviated, when there are things that I don't run past the Anarchist Central Committee or past the Synod of Anarchist Bishops, you know, I get excommunicated, blasphemy. And it's extraordinary to me that they claim to be about thinking for oneself and non-hierarchy, but I have never encountered a more rigid, dogmatic, fundamentalist ideology. And the same is going to the left. And I'm gonna shut up in just a minute, but I got a couple more things. One of them is that also, again, raised a Seventh-day Adventist, we didn't even get this crap. But on the left, there is this terrible thing these days, a cooties notion of political, it's like the cooties of politics, that because I don't believe that men can become women, I have cooties, which means anybody who talks to me has cooties, which means now you have cooties, and then anybody who talks to you has cooties. And I did an interview with a guy interviewed me who was a white nationalist or something. I had no idea. I say yes to a lot of interviews. And his questions were actually quite good. And the interview was fine. But there were people who were like, you spoke with a white separatist. Now, therefore, you are a Nazi. And it's like, that's not how it works. It used to be at one point, and I know old school lefties who still, I mean, there are great stories about black people who would talk to KKK members and find out, I mean, this, for God's sake, this, sorry, for goodness sake, this is the whole in praise of all, this is your whole frickin' point.
Well, not only that, just real quick, Derek, Stokely Carmichael debated George Lincoln Rockwell on the radio.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I just, these are all things that I had inside me that have not yet found a place to come out in this discussion that if I didn't, if I kept them in, I was going to get a hernia. So, I just wanted to spew all of that as in terms of what some of the things that have gone wrong with the left, the dishonesty, the hierarchical nature and the cootie nature. And I'm sure there's some others too, but those are some things that I don't know if they've always been there and I was late to the party in understanding them or if they have actually gotten worse recently. Anyway, I just wanted to throw all of that in.
Yeah. Well, I think I'll use this as answering your question will be Keith and I's final statement. So why don't you answer the question first, Keith?
Well, I can certainly relate to much of what Derek said on a personal level because when Ronald Reagan ran for office the first time, I was slightly under the voting age, so I couldn't vote for or against him. But I was hoping he would win, and the reason why is he said he wanted to abolish selective service registration that Jimmy Carter had actually re-implemented during his own term. And the reason I was against selective service registration is that this was in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. And I was interested in the Vietnam War, and I thought, well, that really doesn't seem like a good thing. So, you know, it's probably good that we don't have selective service registration so that they can't have another situation like the Vietnam War. So Reagan said he was for abolishing selective service registration. Carter said he wanted to keep it. Well, Reagan got elected, and when I turned 18, and I was supposed to register for selective service. Well, guess what? It hadn't been abolished. That was one of my early indications that politicians don't often mean what they say. And then a few years later, Ronald Reagan, during the Iran-Contra affair, he was saying he didn't remember selling formidable weapons to the Ayatollah Khomeini. And I was like, well, you know, what's wrong with this guy? Is he just a total dimwit? Is he a liar? You know, is it both? So I had a somewhat similar situation. I can certainly relate to the anarchist Christian fundamentalist comparison as well, but I've also been both. I grew up in two different types of Christian fundamentalism. One of them was the Independent Baptist, who in the South are very, very, very conservative. And then also Christian Reconstructionism, which is an even more conservative type of Calvinism. Like you said, you were a Seventh-day Adventist. Well, we thought Seventh-day Adventists were like a satanic cult or something. Yeah. That's how conservative we were. I've been interested in anarchism my entire adult life and been around anarchists my entire adult life. And I have to certainly agree with your comparison in the sense that, you know, even when I was a Christian Reconstructionist or fundamentalist Christian, if I did something they approved of, they said, well, God's going to get you someday, you know, whereas, you know, the anarchists will send death threats at least the Christians want to defer it to the Almighty, whereas the anarchists want to kill me themselves. I've definitely had that experience as well. And, I for a time when the alt-right movement was started, I used to write for some of their websites on issues of common agreement, you know, before they devolved into a full-blown white supremacist movement. And I've gotten the same thing you have, you know, like you must be a white supremacist because you know some people who know some people who are white supremacists or whatever. It's even beyond guilt by association or something like that. I remember reading once that in Weimar Germany, the anarchist, Rudolf Rocker, the famous anarchist Rudolf Rocker and another famous anarchist, Erich Mosheim, they actually debated the Strasser brothers at one point, you know, like anarchism versus national socialism and then like an actual intellectual debate. I mean, that would be unthinkable today, you know. You'd have the two sides trying to, you know, bringing weapons to the debate and start shooting. So I'm with you. I feel you.
So I guess what I'll say, Derek, is I don't know what it was. So I cut my teeth reading history growing up, and there were certain received narratives, specifically with regards to the United States, and specifically with regards to the Civil War and World War II. And Keith and I, we've already talked about this many times before on my channel. Something about the way those narratives were delivered, I just had a gut feeling were just wrong. Like, people don't act the way, in my experience, they don't act the way that they were purported to have acted. It's like when FDR says, you know, it was an unprovoked attack by Japan. Nobody attacks unprovoked. Very few people do that. So I was a kid, I still didn't know anything about it, but it just smelled off to me. And probably by 2001, I was sort of pretty critical of the U.S. war on terror. And right on time, I'd have been, you know, my late teens, early 20s. So, you know, mid-teens. So, yeah, that area was sort of how I got on there. I was never really super trusting of government, of these kinds of things. But, you know, as far as the left, I think, broadly speaking, and this is sort of my modest proposal here, is beginning with, like, Godwin and others, there was a certain philosophical commitment, which I consider nominalism, that they either implicitly or explicitly embraced, which has been the sort of governing force of all left-wing development since then. And the reason why the left is crazier now is because modern technology has removed the discipline of lived experience. If you're living like a Russian peasant on the field or an industrial worker in, France, then you can't engage in a lot of nonsense, speculation, and voyeurism. The discipline of real life is too great. But we created this technological threshold whereby the impulses of nominalism could reign unchecked because the discipline of life was removed in at least two ways. One was removing certain social institutions that disciplined people, and then creating this very safe bubble world after 1945 with modern capitalism and technology. And that's sort of how I'd like to end it. I'd like to thank you again, Derek, Keith. It's always a pleasure to have you guys on. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. This is the Praise of Folly podcast, signing off.